Welcome to another special Mumbrella 360 edition of the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. This week, we're confessing our greatest marketing stuff-ups to the session Cock-Up Confessional. The panel included Ray Noble, Brand Director for Beam, Nick Stace, CEO of Choice, Anthony Gregorio, Group CEO for Euro RSCG, and John Bradshaw, Brand Director of Lion. And our moderator was Damien Pincus, founder of The Works. Damien asks our panel, have you ever fired anyone for making a mistake? Explain that moment of fear before launching a campaign. At what point do you use social media as an indicator that you've done something right or wrong? Can you be a good leader and have flaws? And is there not enough risk taken in marketing?
Just to welcome the panel, to my left we've got John Bradshaw, who is the brand director at Lion. We've got Anthony Gregorio, who's the CEO, group CEO at Euro. We've got Ray Noble, who's the brands director at Beam. He brought his own Ringer. Cheering squad. And we've got Nick Stace, who's the CEO of Choice Magazine. It's also worth mentioning with Nick that his previous job was... It's going to be an interesting session. Nick also previously worked as the press secretary to Gordon Brown, so he'll have a bunch of cock-ups he can talk about, which should be quite interesting. So there they are, beautiful. So before we get stuck in, I think one of the important things is we spoke to over 200 different marketing directors, chief marketing officers. We spoke to top people in media companies. We'll just show you an intro to some of those.
1, 2, 3.
Marketing cock-ups. So many options, so little time.
Quite a few of them.
I have a monumental cock-up.
It involves drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing an ad that referred to Satan and the devil and the occult.
And they went, you can go and get fucked.
And all hell broke loose.
It certainly got me unstuck anyway.
Wow.
Nobody's actually going to die from an ad campaign going wrong.
I didn't learn anything.
I'm sorry, but I have no idea what you've been talking about.
Okay, sure.
So, it's actually turned out all right. That was easy.
You happy with that?
If that's your attitude, then we can end the conversation right here.
So before we get stuck into the content, there were some interesting learnings for us just actually asking people to be involved with this campaign that we're doing. So just to go through, there are a bunch of people who are actually so arrogant to think that they had never cocked up before. So they kind of responded that I can't think of a cock-up I've ever done, which is kind of concerning. There were also a bunch of people that said they loved the idea, they would really love to get involved, but they ignored our calls ever since that was made. There are a bunch of, I suppose, more corporate people that kind of said you need to talk to our PR department, and they failed to get involved. And of course, there's a bunch of people that are worried about how they're seen. But the good news is there were at least 150 people that were up for it and were quite happy to share some of their cock-ups with us. This is one of our favourite ones.
Well, a few years ago, in an attempt to get an edit approved by a client, I brought a gun to a meeting and pulled it on him and told him that the gun was there to protect his brand identity. And it didn't really go down too well. It was a fake gun, it was a replica. It didn't have the effect that I was hoping it would have, because it actually made him more determined to change the edit. What did I learn from that? I should have brought a real gun and shot the
So there were some main learnings that we picked up from all the interviews that we did. This kind of shows you in terms of there was areas in cock-ups and creative ideas, misplaced enthusiasm, a lot of poor attention to detail where people are ballsed up, ballsing up around client relationships and probably not being honest. Truth in advertising was a really interesting one with this, an era where we can retouch things and make things look like they actually aren't. And also things about forgetting about money. I thought this is a really good quote, because I think in our industry, making cock-ups and failing at things is one of the most important things that we need to do. If we're generally a creative culture and we want to be innovative, the only way you can actually do that is to make mistakes. And I think one of the difficulties for us is that even as children, we're taught that making balls ups and cock-ups is not the right thing to do. And I certainly was punished like this at boarding school, you know, wrapped over the fingers with rulers. And I think even as adults, it's obviously a much more severe thing for making a balls up. But I think it's really important that we actually ignore that and focus on breaking the rules and making some mistakes. So I think there's when we look at great advertising and great work, it's often, it looks so wrong, but ultimately it's actually the right thing to do. And here's a classic example of just trying to think about when that creative person took this idea or the agency took this idea into the client and tried to convince them that this was the right thing to do. It feels so wrong, and yet it was so right. This Benetton campaign, you know, it was famous 15, probably 25 years ago. And again, I still look at that imagery and think, Jesus, how the hell did they sell that to a client? It felt like probably completely the wrong thing to do, but for that brand, it was certainly the right thing to do at that point. And they did many different executions that were equally as sort of daring as that. And the guy who spoke yesterday, Paul Merrill, who I spent a fair amount of time working with when we launched Zoo, he consistently did things that I just thought, oh my God, are you fucking joking? You know, he gave away boob jobs. He did an article about how to make your own bomb and be a terrorist. But ultimately, he continued to have great success with that magazine. And getting Nikki Webster on the front cover for me was, again, I just thought, this just doesn't seem the right thing to do. But that was the highest selling Zoo Weekly magazine in their history, 160,000 copies. So that just is a lesson to be learned. So I think, you know, our main learning out of all this information that we've got is if ultimately our job as agencies and clients is to do innovative and creative work, the most important thing is that we actually create environments that allows people to do it. So the main thing I think the panel we're going to discuss today is, you know, how do we actually do that? How do we make people around us feel comfortable to do that?
So, the agency and I are having a little bit of trouble selling our latest work through to the CEO before we go to production. In fact, so much trouble that the CEO had asked to see some alternative routes in this week's creative presentation.
We had a big pitch. We didn't win the pitch. We decided that the work was too good, and we try and get on the phone to a competitor to present that same work to the competitor.
We're meeting with the client team, three young female executives as well. The product that they're briefing us on is a sexual aid product. And we just want to make sure, whatever you do, don't embarrass us in this meeting. And I said, look, you can rely on me. I can handle myself well. It turned out that the product was a new vaginal lubricant.
The agency CEO at the time and I hatched this cunning plan where we'd cobble together the cuttings from the creative room floor into the worst piece of advertising we could think of, present that as the alternative route, and like presume the CEO was finally going to see the light and buy our brilliant creative idea.
Anyway, got the meeting. It fell to me as the most junior member of staff to amend the boards. You have to remember that in the early 90s there was no such thing as amazing software where you could just click a button and make that stuff happen really easily and then print out all the new work. This was all done manually. So we did exactly that. Patched over all the work with the new logo, went into the pitch, everything was going swimmingly, and about a third of the way through the presentation, one of the logos fell off.
And during the meeting, my mind wandered, and I squeezed out some of the product, and I was feeling it in my fingers, and then I tasted it, and I said, hey guys, this product's going to be a great success. It tastes wonderful.
The CEO loved the piece of work that we thought was shit, and promptly proceeded to insist that we went and made that.
The client went, why is my competitor's logo on there? And then realised that all the work had his competitor's logos on there underneath his logo. Embarrassing moment.
The room was very silent. There was a lot of red faces. And we won the business, but I was never allowed back again to meet the client.
What happened then is that the agency and I spent the next 3 months effectively polishing a turd and then spending a couple of $1 million airing said shiny turd on television.
So my learnings from that, I think two things. First of all, never trust the most junior member of team in the studio to get something right on a pitch. And secondly, and more importantly, I think, you know, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. So make sure you think about all eventualities.
The lesson, think before you speak.
Well, I think we learned a lot about CEO behaviour. One is that really you shouldn't let CEOs have any say over the script. They're vastly underqualified and have an overinflated view of their own creativity. And secondly, you can never underestimate a CEO's ability to say, make it anyway, and leave you with the results.
So let's get stuck into the questions. So for you guys, and maybe we'll start with John, is have you ever actually fired anyone for making a similar mistake? And where do you actually draw the line in allowing people to make balls ups in your team?
It's a good question. I don't think I've ever fired anybody for making a mistake, although I'm sure I felt like it often. But I do think there's a pretty obvious line between someone who's taken a risk and it hasn't paid off, you know, and a living, breathing, walking retard, right? And they're reasonably easy to spot. So, no, I don't think I've ever fired anybody for making a mistake, but there is a difference between a brave risk taker who didn't pull it off and someone who's just not very good at the job.
And
it's not always that easy to spot the retards, I've found. But I think exactly that. If it's a mistake that was a genuine one and was about you know, truly trying to explore something to get to a better place and it didn't work out, well, you can't fire someone for that. So.
Yeah, Ray from Jim Beam. I'm Damien's favourite client by far because I'm into anything and up for everything. But no, I've never had to fire anyone. And at the moment, probably the more cock-ups I've had than anyone is with you guys in the works. and yet, you know, you're our valued creative lead agency. So I think it's important that if you don't let people push you, then you get nothing, sort of thing. You know, like there's nothing like, you don't want to be known as, for me anyway, you don't want to be known as a safe pair of hands. You know, like you need people that are safe pairs of hands in your team, but you don't want to be thought of as a safe pair of hands. You want to be thought of as, and probably not thought of either as a maverick, like you said before, you know, the retard that just keeps going too hard, but you want people that are willing to push you that little bit step further because you end up with the great result.
Maverick's such a better word for it, isn't it?
Thank you, Ray. Nick?
Yeah, no, I've never sacked anyone for that. In fact, you might turn around and say, why would you do that? Because, in fact, you know, you've just cost me quite a lot to train you very well. But you've now got experience, you've been through the experience of something that's gone wrong, and in a way, that's the best training you can have. So it would be quite the reverse, probably, I think, unless that person was going to be a serial problem, then I wouldn't sack them. But I've worked in environments which I think, unfortunately, have been the reverse to risk-taking. They've been risk-averse. So actually, I'd be more inclined to sack someone or to move them on if they weren't taking more risks. So mine's been the kind of reverse of that, and particularly working in government. You might think that government constantly takes risks and that's why it constantly gets it wrong. In fact, the reverse is true. Often governments are so cautious and so conservative in the way they approach things that that's the reason why they get it wrong, and that they're constantly trying to reduce the chances of failure. Which in itself maximises the chance of failure and reduces actually the chance of ever getting it right and being successful. So I think you could turn this on its head and say you'd be more inclined to move someone on actually if they weren't taking risks.
Right. Okay, so we'll just move on to the next segment.
I'd say that my biggest cock-up involves drugs.
We wanted to do some marketing to the kids at the big day out, so we got frisbees and key rings made up and the marketing staff handed them all out, and the crowd was gathered there in front of the main stage waiting for a band called Fear Factory, who are like a metal band, and before Fear Factory, UMI came on. So they bombarded UMI with the frisbees and the red key rings, so that when UMI a couple of hours later came over for an interview on camera and they said, oh, this is great, who's this with? Because we were very new. We said, we're Red, the music channel. And they held up a frisbee and they went, you can go and get fucked.
Yep, I took a TV presenter to do an interview with Alan Jones, and he woke up with a really, really bad flu, and I picked him up in the cab, stopped, got him everything I could think of, jumped back in the cab, and he started taking lozenges left, right, and centre. When we arrived to do the interview, in the lift, he started to lose sensation of his tongue, and he couldn't talk. What's wrong? I asked him. He said he couldn't even respond. He'd had an allergic reaction.
Really probably hiring the wrong people too hastily. And I think sometimes that gets you unstuck. It certainly got me unstuck anyway.
And we had created this magnificent campaign, had that real tear-jerking stuff, beautiful production qualities. Everyone's very proud of it. It ran, got lovely cut-through from a point of view of the market research. Customers said, yes, terrific campaign, thought it was great, really understood, took out the message, except the message they took out was this is a campaign not from Optus, but from Telstra.
Back in my first job in an advertising agency, I worked in non-campaign and really text-based heavy ads, and I managed to get the phone number wrong in a response advert.
Our biggest cock-up has been essentially following the money and not the right word. A number of times we've seen a commercial opportunity, pursued that opportunity, only to find out it's the wrong client with the wrong work for us, and it all ends in tears.
When I was head of marketing for McDonald's in Australia, and our agency had come to me with just a fantastic idea for a TV ad, and they were playing a game using an Ouija board. Anyway, it was a bit of fun, but I wrestled with the idea on whether or not we should use a Ouija board. And on the night it went to air, McDonald's received over 3,000 phone calls complaining about doing an ad that referred to Satan and the devil and the occult.
And what I learned from it, I think, was I remember my manager taking me aside when I was in floods of tears and saying, nobody's actually going to die from an ad campaign going wrong.
I guess the lesson there is, you know, if it involves drugs, if in doubt, don't.
What I learned was that when it comes to the way people think and the way they behave, regardless of cultures, you have to scratch a bit below the surface.
So the learning was, make sure you really understand what your brand position is, how your brand position is different from the other guy, and ensure that any investment and creative asset that you create for that particular brand does give you full credit and not your competition.
So don't hand out ammunition when you're sampling. Always make small things that can't be thrown at you.
So let's kick off with the first question. I think, you know, when we do great work, there's this adrenaline rush and excitement about an idea. So I think the main question to you guys is, when you've got that fantastic idea, what's that moment of fear like, whether you're going to succeed or fail, when you're just about to invest in a big campaign? For John.
I actually think it's almost the opposite. If I haven't got that horrible sense of fear just before the campaign goes to air, that's the moment when it's all going to go horribly tits up, right? I like that feeling. Am I weird?
No.
I think that means we might be onto something, and it's not 100% guaranteed success that if I've got the fear, the campaign's going to be good. But I'm struggling to think of an example where I thought everything was going to be all right and we didn't just end up running a safe, boring piece of advertising. So I think the indicator of success is that I'm feeling slightly sphincter-tightened.
But I think whenever I think of the word risk, I instantly think of reward, because it has to be that balance between how far you're prepared to go with what you're going to get in return, sort of thing. You know, if your brand's a pretty healthy brand, if you're an elite athlete about to go to the Olympics, you're not going to change your training routine with a week to go, sort of thing. But if you're a fat, overweight guy that's just got no hope and he wants to reform yourself, then you're going to push a little harder, and you've got to understand the reward at the end. So for me, it's try to not think of the fear and think of the reward at the end of it, and be prepared and brave to go for it. So that's where my head's at. And then, you know, if things fuck up, and they do, blame your agency. No. Actually, that's pretty unfair, because once you're, and I firmly believe this, that if you don't 100% adopt an idea, once, you know, you might think, oh, I'm not 100% sure, you've got to trust your gut, but once you're in, you've got to be in 100%, because you're a partnership, and the blame game is the worst thing you can do when it comes to not accepting the thing. So you got to commit and be in.
Thanks, Ray.
I think being in a safe area is a very dangerous place to be, particularly for you know, companies these days, because let's face it, most corporates are geared to taking risk out of any situation, but when you look at pretty much any category that exists, parity is pretty much, you know, parity abounds. You know, it's not like in the drinks category where both of these two guys play. You know, there's a lot of difference between one product versus another, and if there is, it doesn't exist for very long. So I think you have to take a risk, and I think, you know, great creative thinking is the last legal way to get an unfair advantage in business. And so if you don't take that risk to create something that's going to potentially, you know, let's face it, if you take a risk, it's going to upset people, and they have more means than ever before to complain via social media. But the reality is, if you're not taking a risk, you're playing in a safe zone. Then I couldn't think of anything worse than someone not responding to a campaign. So, you know, good or bad, I think that's not necessarily a bad thing for a brand.
Mm. And Nick?
Yeah, I think brands are remarkably resilient. So I know there should be some fear, particularly on the agency part, you know, for any campaign they're about to run, because hopefully that means they're taking some risks and hopefully it's an innovative campaign. But on the other side, you've got to remember that you've got to work really hard to trash a brand. I mean, there are good examples of that, and I think what it comes down to is understanding what is the one brand value that you have to protect at all costs. So for Choice, that brand value is trust. I mean, if we really, really hit at trust and we undermine trust that people have in us, then really it's game over. For other organisations, we were talking about Ratner's earlier, the chain of jewellery shops in the UK, which is, you know, it was cheap jewellery. I mean, their brand value, I imagine, was value. Until Ratner, Mr. Ratner, you know, rocked up and said, actually, you know, a prawn sandwich lasts longer than our jewellery. Now, at that point, you know, he trashed the core brand value. And that's a highly risky strategy. So I would say that, in a sense, fear of a campaign, if you think that it's going to in some way damage your core brand value, well, then don't do it. but you'll be right to be concerned about it.
Thanks, Nick. And I suppose the second question here is, you know, the era of social media, what do you actually judge as a bad reaction? You know, is, you know, Joe Talcott talked about getting 4,000 complaints from McDonald's campaign. You know, at what point do you kind of use social media to get an indication of whether things are going right or wrong? Nick, do you want to...
Yeah, I'm not sure in Choice we've got it terribly wrong on social media yet, except I did think we got it wrong about a year ago, and then I realised we hadn't really. We seem to got a whole load of comments around something that we'd done, an idea that we'd launched, and there seemed to be hundreds and hundreds of comments until I realised that six people produced 90% of those comments. And actually, when you then start to sort of, if you interrogate, you know, who is actually commenting, then actually you realise actually this is something that's being completely blown up and you need to manage that. But you also need to know that the scale of it isn't quite as big as you thought it was. So I think you can sometimes worry about, you know, the great numbers of people who are commenting, and actually then you can distill it, actually, and it's down to a very few people. So I think probably the worst thing in many ways about life in general is if people don't comment on you. So in a funny sort of way, you know, I would feel more concerned if actually we launched a campaign or we did something and it got no reaction.
Yeah, and I mean, look, negative comments, they're not good, but you can turn that into a positive and go, people are that passionate about your brand that they're upset at what you're doing and they're prepared to tell you. So I think, you know, you've got to listen to all consumers and take it all on board and move forward from there.
I think the other issue is you can pretty much piss off anyone at any point, you know, no matter. It's very difficult to create a campaign that pleases everybody. And I would argue that if you do, then it's probably not a very good campaign because just people don't care. But someone a planner once explained to me that brands are like clubs, and it's important as much you know, as who is in that club as who is not in that club. And I think it's important to rail against that tension as a brand. So by that very nature, sometimes you're going to piss people off and. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if it creates some talkability about your brand. As, you know, obviously there's degrees with everything, but I don't think you should be afraid of negative comments around your brand. You just have to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think, well, certainly personally, I'm kind of learning about how this works in this new kind of social world where everybody gets to comment on everything. You know? You used to wait for somebody to complain to some amorphous ad standards bureau about something you'd done, or maybe if you had a fundamental product issue, you might hear about it. But it was actually very hard to hear anything, right? So most of the time, even if it was bad, it might show up in the tracking. That would be about it, at which point it's too late, right? Yet nowadays, they can not like the music on your ad, and you can get, you know, a couple of thousand vitriolic complaints. And I think we've got to recalibrate somehow what bad news looks like, because it's gone from five or six bad things is definitely something worth paying attention to, because people have gone to a lot of effort to complain, to someone bored at 11 o'clock at night on Facebook slagging off your ad is not something I should be worrying about. But it's so much more visible. To be honest, I don't know the answer to the question.
Well, can I just add also just a couple of small examples of that you know, consumers now, of course, are using social media in a very big way, and actually to bring about quite a lot of change in the way that they're being dealt with by companies as well. So, I mean, a couple of examples. Everyone's probably seen Dave Carroll's United Breaks Guitars, the video. If you haven't, you should type it into YouTube. You know, 10 million people have now seen that video clip, and it relates to an issue where, for those who don't know, where Dave Carroll was travelling on United, and he looked out the window as the plane landed, and his guitar was being thrown from one baggage handler to another, and it dropped. And of course, when he picked it up at baggage reclaim, it was broken. And he tried to get United to take responsibility for it. They wouldn't. He then turned around and said, well, don't worry, I'll write a song about it. And they said, go for your life. And of course, he did. And he's now 10 million people have seen that, or 12 million people have seen that. 100 million people know the story. According to the Times recently, they reckon it cost United 180 million pounds, UK pounds, in a loss in share value. So, I mean, it is quite incredible how one person now, you know, with the use of YouTube and other media, can really make a big difference. And in this country, another good example is a guy called Adam Brimo, who, while on the phone to Vodafone, found he was getting terrible service. So he literally set up a website called Vodafail. Now, he's attracted 280,000 people to that site. 22,000 people have taken part in a class action. So, in a way, I sort of spoke about it from a choice perspective, where I think it's been pretty modest in terms of you know, the way that we've been interacting with social media so far. But I absolutely know that consumers are kind of taking it into their own hands and really, really causing some real pain to some companies.
And I think, Damo, it's opened it up, because we were talking before how Australia might be a isolated little place where you can test things, and with big global brands and global companies, that used to happen. But now, anything that gets on social media, our global partners are seeing it pretty quickly and knocking on our door and saying, what the hell are you guys doing down there? So it's opened it up from being, you know, where we were a bit more contained and we could take a few risks, to now, if you're a corporation, you need to be mindful of that as well. Certainly I've found that to be a new phenomena.
Yeah, and I think the point that I suppose Nick makes is that ultimately that brand actually has a choice to accept that and do something about it. Instead, they've done the opposite and they've been hit by the consequences of it.
I think the one thing about social media is, if you have an organisation and a set of values where you don't allow people to make what is very obviously a common sense decision, in the case of the United thing, you know, he had a guitar that worked before he got on the plane, it doesn't work afterwards, someone should do something about it. But the organisation, whatever happened, it didn't allow the people at the face of that issue to address it. Social media can kill you, you know. But I'd argue that the lack of common sense that is applied in many of the situations where these kind of things happen is just kind of staggering. And it's just recklessness, really. But, you know, it's kind of the corporate culture, really, these days.
Okay, let's move on to our next bit of content.
My biggest cock-up in marketing, it would have to be turning down the opportunity to work with Dan Wyden at Wyden & Kennedy.
At quite short notice, I was asked to interview Danny Minogue.
I was at London Heathrow and I had to phone a colleague, so I went to a phone box, put my files on top of the phone, made the phone call and walked away, having left a full 12-month brand plan on top of a phone box in London Heathrow Terminal 4.
So I did this big marketing conference. There must have been 1,000 people in this auditorium.
I put together this 30-minute presentation that had all the greatest buzzwords in it and all these new words that I come up with, and I was the man. I went up and presented it, 30 minutes, stood in front of them. At the very end, silence. Some guy at the back stuck his hand up and said, "I'm sorry, but I have no idea what you've been talking about for the last 30 minutes.
I was at an event with Silverchair. I wasn't quite sure who or what Silverchair was, and a man came up to me and he said, "I'm from Silverchair." And I said, "Ah, what sort of furniture do you make?"
I was in the UK at that point, didn't know much about her or about politics, and the bio told me that she'd been married to a chap called Julian McMahon, whose father had been the Australian Prime Minister. So my first question to her, to sort of break the ice, get it nice, was, "What's it like to have a politician for a father-in-law?" To which her answer was, "Well, he's dead." I suppose what I learned there was, if you can, do some research.
Biggest learning out of all this stuff is simplification and plain English.
What I learned from that was that, I guess when an opportunity presents itself, you just grab it by the balls. Having said that, I do prescribe to the man who makes no mistakes, makes nothing. And now I've got a wicked agency and a wicked family. So it's actually turned out all right.
So the panel, I mean, you all of you are sort of leaders within your groups and companies. Can you actually be a good leader and have flaws?
Who wants to go? Testy, one, two. Look, mate, I certainly agree with that. It's never an easy thing to do, but I think, if you're only a person that talks about all the good stuff you do, people look at you pretty shallowly. And if you talk about the stuff-ups that you do, it's certainly, I think it gains you a level of trust with people and also a level of respect that you are human. I'm almost subhuman, but I think it's important that you do talk honestly. And like I said before, most of my cock-ups have been with you. So funny thing is, you don't talk about the safe things that you do. You actually talk about a few of the brilliant things you do, but you quite often like to talk about the things that you stuffed up. And I think that's healthy. Some of my best things that I've done are things that have failed. Don't know, that sounds weird, but it's good learning and good soul building. So certainly I think you should be open and honest with your team.
I agree. I think it's kind of a newer thing in the kind of leadership bullshittery you can read on the internet, but it's one of the ones I subscribe to. I like this notion of authenticity in leadership being actually at the heart of how to do it well. And maybe that's just because it allows me to be a plain-spoken northern English bloke rather than having to try and hide it anymore. But I kind of like that, and I actually think it's true of brands as well, especially now we've got the social media thing. I think as a leader, it's good to be authentic and to be upfront about when you've made a total pig's ear of it. And I think the same is true of brands. I think you'll get more respect from your consumer if you allow your brand to show its dirty underside at times as well, right? And just accept that we don't always get it right. Mm-hmm. I think you get more respect and more love as a return for it. Mm. It seems to be the new thing, but I kind of like it.
Yeah, no, I obviously agree. I mean, it is part of the new authenticity. Sounds like it's a new word, new concept. It's been around forever more, hasn't it? But I think it's now sort of valued in senior leadership positions in a way that it once, perhaps before, wasn't. And I think you've got to be a bit more humble as a leader now than maybe you had to in the past. And that's probably a good thing, not only to make the connection with your staff and your customers, but also by recognising what you're no good at, really, quite frankly, you're not very good at. Hopefully you surround yourself with people who are good at those things. And if not, then your organisation, as much as you are, become delusional. And then you do get, as you said in that clip, a chief executive who thinks that he's creative and making decisions about, the direction of brands, which really he shouldn't be making. So I think it's really important that chief executives are and senior leaders are aware of what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. But I would just add, there are some flaws, though, that I think you can't have as a senior leader. So I do think, while it's important to be upfront about flaws and to understand them, there are one or two which I think, if you don't have these characteristics as a leader, you shouldn't be leading. And one of them, I think, quite honestly, is to be able to inspire the people who work with you. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be some, egotistical sort of whatever. But it does mean that you have to kind of give people a sense of the direction and a reason and a purpose for, working for that organisation. I think there are certain, if that is a flaw of yours, that you can't do that. I'm not sure you're a leader. So I think there are probably one or two characteristics that, you know, if you don't have, then you shouldn't be leading.
Yeah, and I think the only thing I'd add and agree with all of those points is that I think the one thing that you know, to be fallible is to be human, and I think one of the things that's great about this country is that you probably get away with mistakes a little bit more than you do in some other environments, some other cultures, and you know, I work for a multinational organisation. I sit in various presentations from time to time from people around the world who would make you, you know, would have you believe that they were the genius behind everything and did everything themselves and so on and so forth. And the reality is that stuff just doesn't fly with normal, sensible people. You know, I think, you know, you have to... No one's perfect, everyone makes mistakes, and I think the greatest kind of icons in terms of business and well, not just business culture, but also, you know, in various fields of arts and fashion and music, etc., they failed many, many times before they've succeeded, and that's just mm-hmm. that's just life. And I think being able to be honest about that's a really crucial aspect to being able to be a good leader.
Mm. Okay, let's just move on to our last bit of content.
The one that really stays with me was working with a client who was auditing us, putting me under a lot of pressure, which was really, really hard.
This one goes back to 2007, when I was just starting as the CEO of ACP Magazines in what proved to be one of the most tumultuous periods for magazines in Australia.
And the pitch for the Eurotunnel comes to the agency, and as a little junior, I am asked to take responsibility of the process and making sure that the ads get made.
We needed to do an ad that was about youth unemployment, and we needed to get a guy that was, or a girl, that was in their 20s who couldn't find work. And our problem was we couldn't find anybody who couldn't find work.
And at some point I was on the phone and I started scribbling on a business card. I was half aware I was doing it, and I changed the surname to the word wanker.
And the idea was it was a montage of four shots. The fantastically clean, very peaceful looking person sitting in a Eurotunnel, juxtaposed against unbelievably crowded and hectic Heathrow, a terrifyingly looking overloaded ferry, and amazing traffic hold-ups on the main motorway down to Dover.
A deadline got very close, so I turned to my mate and said, listen, we'll take a picture of you. No one knows who you are.
The following day, we opened the papers. There's this amazing ad. Clients delighted. He could not believe the reaction they got. In fact, the reaction was so strong, there was a question in the House of Lords on the Monday.
And then about 10 days later, this important documentation we had to send over to us. I gave it to my PA and I gave her the business card with the word wanker on it, which I'd forgotten about, and I went to a meeting.
In a very short, very rapid 12-month period, we decided to sell our magazine business in the UK. Closed the Bulletin. We passed on the potential to acquire the Time magazine portfolio, including Who. But we did acquire EMAP magazines with Zoo and New Woman.
A couple of days later, an ad appears in the paper, and there's my mate looking scruffy and disgruntled, with a big headline across the top saying something like, I can't find a job.
The government rings the client, and the client rings the MD rings me, and I ring the art director. It was like the cat. And the art director rang the photographer, and the photographer said, when we went down to the A20, there was no traffic on it. So what we did was, we took a picture of an empty road and we stripped in 4,000 cars. And I said, well, what about the ferry? Well, we did the same thing at the ferry. And Heathrow? No, well, the problem was Heathrow was empty.
Got out the meeting 2 hours later, and she had taken it upon herself, because she's very good at her job, to write a fax note to the client from Mark Molden to Judith Wanker.
The day after, on the front page of the Territorian newspaper is a picture of my mate with the big headline, Sydney ad execs poses as unemployed person.
So what have I learned from that? Two things. First thing, if you are going to recruit a PA, get a clever one. Second thing, if you are going to come up with a nice little name for a client, don't use the word wanker. It doesn't work.
First thing I learned from that was the truth is usually better than complete lies, particularly in the national press, when it's a subject as sensitive as something the House of Lords have been looking at. Good start. Second thing I learned was never send an art director and a photographer out when the concept is so clear, all they want to do in a pitch situation is please the client. and they can never find the right shot, so they'll make it up. And the third thing I learned was, in the heat of a pitch, be careful what you ask for.
I think the key learnings for me at the time is, first of all, understand your risk tolerance as a business, your shareholders, your board, and also what sort of assets you have. In this case, we had a portfolio of assets, and we could take decisions knowing that some of them would work out and others wouldn't, but collectively, we were in a position to take those sort of risks. It's also important to be able to make decisions. Often organizations struggle when they don't control the timing. You know, the markets we operate in are very fluid, and you need an organizational culture where you can quickly make considered decisions and get on with things. I think the decisions you regret are often the ones you didn't take. Finally, I think in that period I learned to never bet the farm on Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan, and Britney Spears. They will not sell your product forever, and we might have gone a bit long on celebrity gossip.
And I guess what I learned from that was, this might be marketing, but if you possibly can, try and tell the truth. Try not to fabricate evidence.
So to the panel, you know, in our industry, do we actually think that we suffer from not taking enough risks? John?
I think that's what I love about our industry, isn't it? In the main, we're pretty bloody good at it. You know, there are ways of killing risk-taking in advertising. I know certainly most of my agency friends would claim research is the death of risk-taking in advertising. That's a conversation for another time. What I love about this job is it's got some creativity at the heart of it, and that in itself is a risk-taking thing. So, I think we're in the right place. I think we should populate our industry with risk-takers. That's hopefully what attracts us to do this job.
Ray?
I probably think that we do not take enough risks. In the boozer game that I work in, it's very regulated. You're forever trying to look to be able to push the boundaries without breaking the code. You know, then there's financial implications. It's not my brand that I work on. It's worth a lot of money, and so I've got to take that duty of care on. When there's things you've got to report back to the board and share prices and all that kind of stuff, all those things play on your mind when you're considering how big a risk to take. So I think we should certainly push the boundaries, but there's definitely parameters that play in the back of your mind, and hopefully you can sometimes let those things go. But I know that there's a reality that does exist, and so how you overcome that, got to have a decent set of balls on you. Or like I told Damien, no, maybe I shouldn't say
that. No. Oh, I'm moving on to Nick.
Follow that. Look, I think sometimes communicators get blamed for stuff, you know, if it's not risk enough, if it's too risk averse, if it's too risky, if you know, the Prime Minister doesn't appear so good now, if, you know, it's all about the communicator. And actually, perhaps it's the organisation that you work for. If that organisation, you know, is prepared to take risks, then the communicator is then liberated to take risks as well. And so I think maybe the focus can be a little wrong to say, is it the agency or is it the communicators within an in-house situation that are not taking enough risks? Sometimes it's the business. And I understand that also from an organisation that's 50 years old and also other organisations that I've been involved in, it's quite difficult for organisations to feel they can take risks. And sometimes, and something we mentioned a bit earlier, sometimes actually it takes setting up almost like a pirate operation, you know, to be able to take risks. So a great example of that is a French company called Telefonica that in the UK recently, or about 3 or 4 years ago, set up a competitor to itself, and it set up a company called GiftGaff, and it couldn't do what GiftGaff does, and that is basically build a consumer platform. The consumers themselves decided, you know, the products that the company was going to sell, and it was an incredible concept, but that couldn't have happened within Telefonica. It had to be something that was set up outside of. And, you know, the communicators had a great job with GiftGaff because the product, the company, was up for the challenge of taking risk and doing something innovative and different.
Yeah, no, sorry, just I think it's a lot easier to take a risk when your brand's going backwards at a rapid rate of knots. So, you know, you get the graph out and you're saying, in 5 years' time, if you do nothing, you're there, then suddenly the risk is a lot easier to adopt. But if your brand's tracking really nicely, you've got to have a lot more courage to be able to take that risk. But, you know, reality is you don't know what's around the corner, so you've got to be forever trying to push it. So I think it's also to do with where your brand is and how big you're prepared to go.
with a risk.
And then?
Yeah, I think, you know, innovation tends to be the lifeblood of most categories, and innovation is fundamentally a risky business. You know, you can't necessarily learn from the past to build a picture of what the future holds and what's going to work in the future. So I think, you know, one of my favourite quotes and something we talk about a lot at the agency is, you know, one of the greatest sort of innovators of modern time, Albert Einstein, said, you know, imagination is more important than knowledge. And I think that's true. You know, you have to learn as much as you can, but at some point you have to sort of step off the ledge and go for it. And you just can't do that without taking some sort of risk. So it's important to do in everything we do.
Maybe just to take that analogy further, there is something that I remember all the time, and it's a quote from a British Prime Minister whose name I forget because I'm deeply flawed, right? And it's like, you cannot leap a chasm in two small steps, right? And sometimes you've just got to kind of hang it out there and go for it, I reckon.
All right, so we're now right at the end of our session. We might open the floor for some questions. Has anybody got a question?
Sorry, thanks. Great presentation. This is James Wright from Red Agency. Most of the biggest cock-ups I've seen in marketing comes from recruitment. Recruitment can put you back, I guess, years or months. I was just wondering if I could ask each of the panel if they could share the biggest cock-up in terms of recruiting. And Ant, you can't say when you recruited me.
This one's an easy one.
Coatsy, you can leave now, mate.
I've recruited the marketing team, and they're our ex-party crew girls right there hiding in the front rows. No, to be honest, I haven't had an awful lot of that, thank God, touch wood. And I guess the policy we've had in internally, whether it's right or wrong, is we've done a lot of recruitment from within. So you see talent, you see people that shine. You watch them grow, and you, more than anything, I look for, rather than skill set, you look for the right attitude. Because you can teach people anything, but you can't teach them the right attitude. So I think the attitude is probably the primary thing that you look for. Sometimes you do stuff up, and I've got a couple of examples, but most times your gut's pretty good when it comes to attitude, so particularly if you've had time to work with them. So that's the ultimate, be able to work with them and understand them before you move them on.
I mean, I think it's a really good question, right? Because I think you're absolutely right. But I think it's the reason why I put more time, process, research and effort into recruiting than I do anything else. Like, my ads don't go through the pain that, like, people who come and work for us have to do. I think it's the single most important bit of the job, and the probably thing you've got to de-risk.
Yeah, it's probably the biggest de-risk. Right? Interesting, we're talking about taking risks, but try to minimise the risk as much as you can when it comes to the people you employ.
Yeah, I tend to agree with all of that. I think if you're a good recruiter, you get it right maybe 70% of time, which means that 30% of time you get it wrong. And the only thing to therefore do in that situation is probably to move those people on quite quickly. So I think Google have the expression, but I don't think it's owned by them particularly, but is to hire slowly, fire quickly. And I think, you know, if there was ever an expression that's right for recruitment, it's probably that one.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is you make mistakes. I've certainly hired my fair share of duds, James. But the reality is, you know, 70-30, I think maybe in agency land, maybe the percentage might even be a little bit higher because you're always under pressure to resolve issues much more quickly for clients. But I think every time I get it wrong, it's because I moved too quickly. I didn't take the kind of fundamental steps I needed to really determine whether the person was right or not. And so it's a good lesson. Unfortunately, it's a lesson I have to relearn sometimes, but it's really important to take those steps and find out what as much as you can what they're really like.
Any other questions from the floor? No? All right, well, we'll wrap it up. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming along, and hope you enjoyed the session.
That's all from the Mumbrella Cast for this week. I'm Tim Burrows. Till next time, toodle pip.